across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
Hello there. We really appreciate you downloading this podcast from the BBC. And don't forget, we're here fighting for you every day of the week. If you want to contact us, nolan@bbc.co.uk. I hope you enjoy today's podcast. The Stephen Nolan Show! Well, the row is ongoing between the Education Minister, Paul Given, and other political representatives at Stormont after it has emerged that not only did he meet with the Loyalist Community Council, which represents the views of the UDA and the UVF, but he has turned down meetings with 205 other groups. Paul Given says he will not be making any apology for meeting the LCC. He's facing fierce political criticism for declining other meetings with other organisations. Speaking to Buckler and Gamu earlier, the South Belfast DUP MLA, Edwin Poots, was asked if there's a danger that DUP ministers meeting reps of loyalist paramilitaries meant the threat they posed was not being taken seriously enough.
There's a complete difference between places like South Belfast and some other areas. And many of those, you know, people who had been involved in paramilitary organisations, you know, over the course of the Troubles, both on Republican and Loyalist sides, have largely stepped back from everything that's involved with. And they still have a friendship. They still have, you know,
it specifically says in the programme for government that the communities where paramilitary gangs continue to exert coercive control. It says the cost to the economy is a minimum of £750 million per year. And that's why I'm asking, is there a danger in your words and the way you talk about paramilitaries and in the way it's being treated by some other members of your party, that there's a danger of not taking paramilitaries seriously enough?
So I'm reflecting purely in South Belfast terms what's happened. And, you know, I don't hear of punishment beatings. I don't hear of the intimidation or things that went on during the period of the Troubles. But I do think, you know, you as an organisation need to reflect that people, there is many people across Northern Ireland who have simply retired from all of that. Whether they should have ever been involved in it or not, it's an entirely different matter. But who are not involved in any of those activities that you would associate with a paramilitary organisation, but they did have a paramilitary past. And that is the case for a large swathe of Northern Ireland. Unfortunately, it isn't the case throughout Northern Ireland. And I think that we do well to focus on where people actually have done good things and have went on to generate employment, generate social businesses which are for the public good and so forth, and have moved entirely away from the past. People need to move away from the past, and that's a course of work that I was heavily involved in all of my political career. And whilst I'm somewhat restrained in the role that I have now, I will quietly in my constituency continue to do that.
So, that's Poots speaking to Buckler this morning. What do you reckon? 030-30-80-55-55. There seems to be, coming from the DUP, clear messaging now, not just from Edwin Poots, but from Gavin Robinson, that these people who remain in the UDA, UVF, need further encouragement, further understanding, further reaching out to them, in order to get them to finally say it is over. But will it ever be over for the UDA and the UVF? You had Bran Irvine, for example, on Nolan in recent days, saying that, look, these people are in the background, ready, waiting and ready, should the need arise to defend what they see as their country again. The SLP councillor, Seamus de Foyche, with us this morning. Morning, Seamus.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. You submitted the FOI then to the Department of Education. So you've got these figures. Mr. Given, our Education Minister, has turned down 205 other groups but found time to meet the LCC.
Yes, Stephen, I think all political representatives and particularly ministers will have diary pressures that exist. There's no politician I would be aware of who can take every request that comes into their inbox. But I think the really clear issue here is about whether or not there's been prioritisation of the LCC over other groups that have very legitimate concerns, very legitimate issues that they want to address to the minister. And instead, the LCC, as I've discovered through the Freedom of Information request that I submitted, sent a one-line email to the minister and managed to secure a meeting on that basis.
Why do you think it happened?
I have a real concern that there is a deference and being shown to the LCC, which I have a lot of issues with, not least the fact that we are 26 years on from a peace agreement, and yet we still have organisations representing paramilitaries seeking to influence government policy.
But is it not better that those groups are seeking to influence education, influence housing, rather than sitting out and just talking to the UDA and UVF and hearing about the UDA and UVF and what their future plans are to, if they ever had them, to kneecap people, to shoot people, to deal drugs? Is it not better that the UVF is interested in education rather than shooting kids?
Well, rather than talk about future plans, I think maybe we should make a focus on what's actually happening in the present, which is what we've seen in the streets of Belfast over this summer, where violence was turned on and off again like a tap, where police were very clear that they were of the view that paramilitary organisations were involved in making that happen, where we see drug dealing going on a industrial scale in some parts of the city, where the police are very clear that that paramilitary organisations are responsible and behind that. Where all of these things continue to happen, where coercive control is something that we see as being a huge problem in so many communities across Belfast and other parts of the north. And yet here we are, that the representatives of those organisations feel that it is their entitlement to lobby in relation to education policy and to spread fear, because I think we have to be very clear about that. The issue that was raised around Scoil na Sealta in East Belfast has spread fear. And that is a really, really problematic situation for us to be in, that the terror groups have that ability.
But how does it spread fear for the LCC, which is a legal group, as you know? It's an umbrella group.
Well, what is the status of the LCC, Stephen? Is it a registered charity? Is it a registered company with Companies House? How does that entity exist?
Well, the LCC, as you know, was set up by Jonathan Powell. It was set up by one of the Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister's right-hand men.
And how is it legally constituted? Does it have a constitution? Who are defined as it being its members? And are they defined as being members on the basis of their membership of prescribed organisations?
But when you get in, Seamus, and I think this has to be part of the conversation, when you get into the realpolitik of Northern Ireland, which is these people are not just going to put up their hand, I'm talking about UDA and UVF, that senior leadership structure, they're not just going to put up their hand and say, right, we're off the stage now. So how do you get them off the stage?
But I think the frustration for my generation, I'm 32, Stephen, for 26 years we've had a peace agreement in this place that was supposed to allow for the development of normalised politics, where we could focus on things like educational disadvantagement and increasing educational attainment in working class areas in places like Belfast. Instead, what my generation has seen is the promise of that agreement and the promise that we would move away from coercive control, away from paramilitarism and away from almost a kind of mafia-style approach to doing things here, is that those groups have continued to hold a huge degree of influence and sway. And I think the result of this Freedom of Information request demonstrates that there are a huge number of groups, many of whom have been in contact with me, a number of whom have been in contact with me just this morning as the story has broken, to say that they have sought to meet the minister, very legitimate issues, but instead a different group has been prioritised.
Can I come back to that question, Seamus? Mm-hmm. How do you get these people to go away? Like, what do you do rather than just wishing them to go away? What do you do?
I think there are a number of things. For a start, empowering communities to actually work with them to lift communities up out of poverty and destitution, to improve educational attainment rates. There is another side to this, which is the police and injustice element. I have been very clear that whilst I've had issues with the PSNI in relation to other issues, their efforts in East Belfast in trying to tackle paramilitarism and the drug dealing that goes along with that have been very successful in terms of the number of prosecutions both brought and secured. These are all the types of elements that need to be addressed and looked at. I mean, we recently had an all-party Belfast City Council meeting with the Education Minister where I raised his meeting with the LCC. But one of the other issues I raised was about poverty and how we use our schools and school settings to try and address some of the measures around poverty. So things like free school meals for all, a universalist approach which would actually help children, would be able to reach children who aren't don't fall under kind of the traditional markers for poverty, would be able to help kids that might be in situations where there's domestic violence in a household or coercive control or parents with chaotic lifestyles. And those are the kind of measures I think we need to be spending time addressing and talking about and actually prioritising where resources are going to help people. Not to give deference to organisations that are involved in some of the criminality that actually leads to people being stuck in cycles of poverty, like loan sharks, like drug dealing, like all of those kind of things, like protection money.
Well, the minister was very much fighting back and defending his meeting with the LCC in the Assembly yesterday. Let's have a listen.
I've accepted 324 invitations. I've discharged hundreds of those requests. I have been in countless number of schools, community facilities, representing every section of our society and every sector within education. I think if members put in the question to every other minister, I'd be interested to see how many invites and meetings they have attended to see how I can compare against their record, and that's maybe something that colleagues will do. But I will not make any apology for making sure that we seek to move every part of our society forward. And unlike his previous leader, the late John Hume, I do have concern and share some of the concerns that people have been expressed. But when John Hume embraced Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin, when the IRA were up to their neck in murdering people of our country, John Hume's response was, "I don't give two balls of roasted snow what you think." I, however, do have concern and I share those concerns, but I'll continue to work in every community to bring them forward.
Well, that, Seamus, was directed at you, wasn't it? And he's basically saying your party, we're meeting Gerry Adams.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're 26 years on from a peace agreement. Those efforts.
Well, it doesn't matter how far it's on. It's the principle, isn't it?
Because those efforts were very clearly about securing a peace agreement within this place, something that the vast majority of people in Northern Ireland signed up to, that they voted for in a referendum, and they have consistently backed. The majority of political representatives in this place are people who signed up to that agreement and endorsed it.
We can't
stay still in a moment of time and say that 26 years on from the agreement that this is still something that is acceptable.
At what point do we get to
the stage where paramilitarism is totally and utterly off the stage? And let's get down to the brass tacks of this. How much more money are we being told that we're going to be asked for to help fund this transition? Because that's what I think this is really going to come down to. The executive has a responsibility to step up in relation to trying to tackle paramilitarism and ending coercive control. We are bringing a motion to the Assembly in relation to this today, and I'm hoping that the executive parties will be able to back us on that and do so wholeheartedly. But 26 years on...
I've got to be able to put a question to you. Yeah. I've got to be able to do that. How much was Gerry Adams tackling paramilitarism when your party was meeting him and he was carrying the coffins of people who had killed security forces, targeted people because they were Protestant? The Shankill bombers being an example. Have you been on the Shankill Road and watched the destruction, the ongoing, 26 years later, hurt and pain on that road because of what happened? And your party was meeting Gerry Adams.
And the SDLP, and particularly John Hume, was very clear in making a point and trying to speak to as many people as possible to arrive at a peace deal. That is,
Which is what Paul Given is doing.
That is, no, it's not. That was the Good Friday Agreement. We arrived at a place where the vast majority of people in this place voted for an agreement, have consistently backed parties that support the principles of that agreement. We have to move on now, and that means an end to paramilitarism. It means an end to coercive control, to drug dealers and loan sharks, to all the things that go with that. And if we have government ministers continuing to give undue influence to those groups, then we're not going to be able to move on.
Is it your view that Sinn Féin is still directed, controlled by the Army Council?
I don't know. And that is the honest answer to that question, Stephen. I don't know. And I don't know enough about the internal workings of Sinn Féin in relation to that.
But it's the most recent security assessment. So if we took a pure approach to all of this, some people might argue, Seamus, that politics wouldn't function in Northern Ireland. The most recent security assessment is that the Army Council controls Sinn Féin.
I think we've been very clear in terms of our motion that's been brought to the Assembly today that we're not just talking about paramilitarism from one side or the other. I think the SDLP has always been, perhaps one of the few parties in this place that has been clear in saying paramilitarism of any shade whatsoever is wrong. I don't care whether it's the East Belfast, UVF or Ciru and Derry or anybody else for that matter. Paramilitary organisations are wrong and they should be off the stage. I don't think it's wrong to be unequivocal about that.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is if we follow the logic of what you and many others are saying, many others are saying, then why should Sinn Féin not be shunned if they're being run by the Army Council?
Well, I suppose there's a fundamental difference in the fact that the LCC hasn't sought a single vote from somebody, and we don't know anything in relation to how they are actually constituted. But again, the SDLP has always been really unequivocal in terms of its opposition to paramilitarism of any kind. And as I said, there's very few other political parties here who can actually stand on that basis and say that that has always been their position.
Lots of calls on this morning. Here's Mark and Antrim. Morning, Mark. Good morning, Mark.
Can you hear me?
Try Thomas. I can't hear you, Mark. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead.
You see a lot of dodgy boys from both sides of this divide that want to forget about the past. The past, move on from the past, quick and forget about us because we've done bad things. What about the Battle of the Boyne? That was the past. Bloody Sunday was the past. The Easter Rising was the past. These things want to be celebrated on one hand, then move on. Also, all the dodgy boys want to move on, forget about their call for this moving on, while the rest of the people can't move on.
So what are you saying, Mark, about the UDA and UVF? What are you saying? Are you saying they should have influence in terms of our education policy, our housing policy in Northern Ireland? These people run around with masks on when it suits them.
In category. The criminals, if I've been criminals, criminality should be dealt with by the police. To be given some state or some political thing that they want. And
So you do or don't think Paul Given should be meeting them? Meeting representatives of them?
Come, and they shouldn't be allowed even to be acknowledged.
Okay, Mark, thank you. Thomas, morning, Thomas.
Good morning, Stephen. I come from a PUL background, so I do, working class. Biggest issues in them areas now, I can tell you, housing and health, education and the economy. And when I hear the Speaker of the Northern Ireland Assembly on Good Morning Ulster this morning saying how important this historic site is where King William crossed, I don't know if they had railway tracks back in them days. I just go, are the DUP ever going to be fit for government, and will we ever get proper public services away from the past, focused on the future, while the DUP are involved? You look at the behaviour of the two ministers meeting the LCC, and you look at what the Speaker said on Good Morning Ulster this morning, and I listen to your radio a lot of times, and it's all about the past. What about the future? Housing and health, education and the economy. Let's move forward, not back.
Move forward by doing what? What should Paul Given and Gordon Lyons have done when the request came in? What should they have said?
Refused it. Absolutely. They are... I don't want to talk about them. They should have been doing their job. One of them is communities. That's housing. There's 36,000 people on the waiting list for houses. There's no sewage infrastructure to allow the houses to be built. Education, how many mobile classrooms are there in the country? They are ministers with a job to do, not to pander to people who sit in darkened rooms threatening violence whenever they lose the argument. Do we want to move forward or do we want to live in the past? The decision is simple. And the DUP, are they fit for government? Will they ever let the past go, Stephen?
030-30-80-55-55. Seamus, finally with you, Edmund Poots told Buckley this morning that in places like Sandy Row, loyalist paramilitaries have largely left the stage. He said, look, they've retired, they've moved on.
After the violence earlier on in the summer, I visited some of the businesses in Sandy Row that were attacked and burnt out, myself and Councillor Paul Doherty. We spoke to the police on the ground. The police on the ground made it very clear to us that they were of the view that there was a paramilitary element involved in orchestrating that violence.
Elements of the paramilitaries, but not necessarily controlled again. By the leadership of those paramilitary groups.
Within 15 minutes of us having that conversation with the police, we were put out of Sandy Row by a group of 30 men who showed up out of nowhere. I am very firmly of the view that paramilitarism was involved in the violence we've seen, the racist and Islamophobic violence that we've seen in the summer in Belfast. And I don't think it's credible for anybody to say that paramilitarism has gone away from South Belfast or indeed from any part of the city. This is a scourge. It is a cancer in our society. We have to do everything we can to try and tackle it. Otherwise, we can't move forward. That's why we're bringing the motion to the Assembly today in relation to this.
And Seamus, those men who approached you, what did they say?
Probably a lot of things that I can't repeat on radio. I might get your show into a bit of bother, Stephen, but it was made very clear that we had to leave the area and that we would be put out if we didn't. There was one of the individuals who said that they were glad that the shops had been burnt out and that they would very happily see those things happen again. And there were lots of sectarian slurs shouted at us and everything else.
And did they say which organisation they were claiming to represent?
No, they didn't. But, I mean, I think people know that part of the city well enough to know. And again, given the references that the PSNI made in relation to what happened during the summer, what organisations may have been involved.
OK. Seamus, thank you very much. Thanks for coming on this morning. 030-30-80-55-55. Former Sinn Féin election candidate Chris Donnelly with us today. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Former DUP Special Advisor David Graham. Morning, David.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Well, Chris, look, the reality of Northern Ireland is that there are some people who used to be involved in active terrorism who are now trying to encourage people to not engage in any violence whatsoever, and their influence is helpful to the police and society, Chris. Is that not the case?
I think there's probably many people who would fit that category out there in our society 26 years after the Good Friday Agreement. I think many people out there would struggle to accept at face value that necessarily the organisations represented within the umbrella of the Loyalist Communities Council would fit that criteria. The issue here, Stephen, is one of priorities and judgment for Paul Given, in particular as the Education Minister, because after his meeting, of course, at the LCC, they then used that opportunity to have a go publicly about the siting of an Irish medium school. And given the organisations represented under the umbrella of the LCC, naturally, that would be interpreted by people associated with that school in a very, they would be disturbed by that. So I think that is something that is regrettable. It points to judgment issues and priorities, given that, again, we found out overnight that there have been over 200 organisations and individuals who have been frustrated in their endeavours to arrange a meeting with the Education Minister.
Is that not a cheap point? Is it not cheap? I don't mean from you. You haven't mentioned it yet. But is it not cheap to quote that the Minister Given has turned down 205 groups without telling people that he's met over 300 groups? Surely the context is important. So he's met over 300 groups and maybe he hasn't had time to meet 200 groups. The question is, why did he meet the LCC? The 205 figure is it, without context. Is that not cheap?
It's only relevant because it provides the context so that he, you know, amongst that 205 groups that he hasn't represented is not the LCC because he prioritized meeting them. And what did they do when they had the opportunity to meet him? They use it as a platform to attack the siting of a nursery in primary school. So that speaks to priorities and to judgment. That's part of the reason that the education minister is under pressure at the moment.
We'll pause there. 03030 80 55 55. We'll pick this up with Chris and David and lots of you after the news. So the Education Minister, Paul Given, unapologetic after it has emerged. He's turned down 205 groups. He's met over 300 groups, and among them, the LCC.
But when John Hume embraced Gerry Adams and Sinn Féin, when the IRA were up to their neck in murdering people of our country, John Hume's response was, "I don't give two balls of roasted snow what you think."
David Graham, special advisor, former special advisor for the DUP, a lot of public scrutiny around this, and how could there not be, David? Did Given get it right?
Look, I think, Stephen, it's not necessarily about discussing whether they got it right or wrong just yet. I mean, I said to your producer before going on, I think it's important to look at the process as to how any minister meets with a group, whatever that group is and whatever that group represents. And I know that obviously in the first day brief, a minister of every department will discuss what the priorities are for the department. And one of the key roles of the special advisor is to discuss with officials what the minister's priorities are. Now, one of the priorities that the DUP have in around education is tackling education underachievement. And we also know, and it's been discussed in the programme before, the high percentage of particularly young Protestant boys who are underachieving. So if we then take that policy forward, which will be one of the key elements of officials to look at, when various invites come in, the officials will provide a advice. They will provide options, option A, B and C, which will be, this is in line with your priorities in terms of your overall policy direction. So,
given the fact that the LCC represents the views of the UVF and UDA, what advice could the UDA and UVF give the minister? What type of added value is there from hearing what the UDA and UVF think about education?
No, Stephen, it's not about the LCC. It's not about giving advice. I mean, at the end of the day, whatever community group or organisation meet with any minister, they are there to convey the views of that group. So it's not about providing advice.
Why do we care about the views of the UDA and UVF in terms of children? Why do we care? Why aren't they told the opposite? Why aren't they told, get stuffed, get out, stop intimidating children, stop recruiting children? We want nothing to do with you.
But I think, Stephen, as well, if you look at this from a balanced point of view, and I said before, I mean, I'm no advocate or defender of the LCC, but the LCC was set up 2015 by Jonathan Powell, who was chief of staff for Tony Blair, who was one of the key architects of trying to get the Belfast Agreement across the line. Now, when you read his book, he said, and one of the key lines at the end of the chapter, when there was a protest against the Belfast Agreement, he said that the beat of the orange drum, or I'm paraphrasing, but basically the beat of the orange drum would no longer trample upon the rights of all citizens of Northern Ireland. So essentially what he was trying to say there was that people within the Loyalist community who had blocked roads in the UWC protest in 1974, who brought the city a standstill in 1986, that these people no longer had power and influence. However, I think he then recognised 15-odd years later that actually there's a group of people who have been left behind here. Now, look, some of it by their own fault, but also some of it by a failure in the system. And I think that you've mentioned earlier, obviously Seamus is gone now, but I think one of the key things is that Gerry Adams was brought in from the cold. Bill Clinton gave him special visas to travel to America in the early 90s when IRA were still murdering people. So I think the problem is here, Stephen, I've said this to you before, you've young working class people. In fact, you've probably got working class people right across the age demographic within the loyalist community that, as I said, are looking over the peace line, who are saying, hold on a second, they, as they'll describe it, got X, Y, and Z. What have I got? Now, look, that's not necessarily my view, but I think that is where we're getting. And I think that's then, Stephen, where it creates an issue when you're looking at the Boyne Bridge, where, you know, young lads who are probably suffering from lack of education are trying in some way to convey their general angst and anger towards the political system. And thus why we continue to have problems. So, you know, this isn't to blame anyone here, but I think if ultimately we're trying to solve a problem, I think we're actually making this problem worse.
Chris Donnelly?
Yeah, I think I was really glad that David mentioned how the DUP have said they're prioritising underachievement, and that indeed, in their statement about the LCC meeting, they said that was the primary reason for the meeting to discuss underachievement strategies. That, you know, David made reference to the perception out there that people within, you know, young lads moving the Protestant community are looking over the peace wall and seeing what the other side have. You know, let's be clear, there are more poor Catholic boys and girls who underachieve every year in our education system by the measure of 5 good GCSEs than poor Protestants. This isn't the idea that the Catholic areas are some Garden of Eden. And this doesn't get discussed enough. In fact, you know, whilst we're having this discussion about the education minister, those involved in education at the moment, Stephen, are more perturbed about the editorial of the Irish News today about how the education minister is seeking to redefine schools, the eligibility criteria for devising a strategy to target funds towards underachieving children. So under the new education minister, Paul Given, you know, a fee-paying preparatory school in his constituency is deemed eligible for funding. But a school in the working class West Wind Estate in Newtownards, a school in the Glenbrin Estate in North Belfast, schools in Ballymurphy and Turf Lodge are not. They're excluded. In fact, 2/3 of grammar schools under the education minister now are deemed eligible for underachievement funding. But schools in areas like Strabane, but the poorest area outside of Belfast and Derry, are not. That is a fundamental issue that we want to be looking at if you're interested.
I think we should look at it as a programme, and we'll do that on another day. Can I just ask you, Chris, finally, people have been asking this week, what's the reason for the existence of the UDA and UVF? Why does the Army Council still need to be around, Chris, in your view?
Well, I don't think they are. In fact, if they are, who are they? What are they doing? The IRA doesn't exist anymore. They haven't been involved in anything for a very long time. And the only thing, I know you make reference every now and then to a security assessment that says there's an Army Council there. Who are they? I would like somebody to come out and say who they are. What are they doing? Because it would be criminally scandalous to Sinn Féin to allow that circumstance, given that this party is now trying to grow itself to be the largest party across the island of Ireland on the cusp. Until the last year,
You think Sinn Féin would be open about it? Do you, open and transparent?
Well, I think that, well, Sinn Féin, I would imagine the line they'd have is there is no IRA anymore. But if people have any evidence, and you know, the position I would ask is, we know there are dissident Republicans there. We know there are loyalist organizations there. Why? Because we read people like yourselves in the media who are reporting exactly what they're doing week in, week out. We see videos of what they're doing involved in violence. We see references to, like what Seamus DeFeat just said in your show earlier, people targeting individuals, harassing them and likes. No one is coming out anywhere for years and saying the IRA have been involved in that. That's why I question whether this notion that there is an Army Council. I would imagine that there are people who used to be in the IRA, of course, who are in Sinn Féin, but the role is exclusively within Sinn Féin now, Stephen.
Okay. Chris Donnelly, thank you very much. Thank you for calling today as well. 03030 80 55 55. David Graham, thank you to you as well. Wayne, morning, Wayne.
Morning, Stephen. This, in 26 years, this council has been receiving money along with Sinn Féin, probably at the start. I would like to know when Sinn Féin stopped receiving money. I would like to know how much money was received by both parties, in the sense that after 26 years, all the money that the LCC got, what did they do with it? Because it didn't help any of their communities. They didn't build houses, they didn't build parks, they didn't do anything. So was this just like a payroll to stop them from misbehaving?
Well, the LCC don't misbehave, of course. The LCC is a legal umbrella group which represents the views of the UDA and UVF. If you're asking, does money get through from Northern Ireland to the UVF and UDA, you know, go back many, many years ago, the Nolan Show was under intense pressure when we were looking at something called, I don't know if you remember or not, the Social Investment Fund. That was a fund. I remember getting called up to Stormont by very, very senior influential people being told off that we were continuing to scrutinise. Follow the money is what we tried to do and see where it's going and where it's gone.
But where has it gone, Stephen? Where got all this money? I don't. I'm either side of the house. Doesn't matter what community you're from. This is still 26 years on, and let's look at it. Let's look at it practically. Unionism has very little houses in some areas. They have very, very little prospects. But this group of loyalist paramilitaries have got all this money. What have they done with it? They didn't give it back to their communities. And I said, and I say all along, what has the ministers for any loyalist party delivered for unionism? Nothing. All they do is call them out when they need them to bang the drum and let them, encourage them to burn their housing estates, to burn their bus routes.
Well, no ministers. No ministers. Come on. Wise up. No minister. No minister has encouraged anybody. No minister has encouraged anybody to be burning houses or anything like it. And with regards to Paul Given and Gordon Lyons, look at the record of the policies that they've been trying to introduce. You've heard Paul Given talking about the schools he's been out to. You've heard Paul Given, for example, talk about school uniform policy recently and the building of schools. You've heard Gordon Lyons talking about housing policy. Look at the scrutiny committees where he's talking about policies on the ground that he's trying to introduce. You might not like his decisions, you might not like his policies, but it's simply untrue to suggest that they are not doing anything. 03030 80 55 55. And it's ludicrous to suggest that any minister anywhere in Stormont has called for people to burn down other people's homes. It's a false statement from you. 9:45, the police have removed a sign with a sinister threat targeting workers involved in the dismantling of the Boyne Bridge. The message with a crosshair said, "Touch this bridge, beware." Edwin Poots was talking to Buckler this morning, condemned the people behind the sign, but he said he did not believe loyalist paramilitaries in the area were behind it.
Any threat to workers is entirely wrong, and therefore that sign should never have been placed. We are seeking to know who placed it. At this stage, there's no indication that it's done with any authority from a paramilitary organisation.
So this could just be individuals, but even the fact that you talk about the idea of it potentially being placed there with the authority of paramilitary organisations, that in itself is quite a statement, because it suggests that they have some kind of control of that area.
We came through 30 years of troubles, and in those 30 years of troubles, we had organisations springing up right across the community. And, you know, a lot of those organisations are now largely retired and have moved on. And in South Belfast, that's pretty much the case. Therefore, we don't anticipate or expect that there's a paramilitary element to the erection of that sign.
Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris is with us today. Good morning, Alison.
Good morning.
Good morning. Former senior police officer John Burrows with us today as well. Good morning, John.
Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. So, Alison, even the fact that Poots can convey the intelligence that he's managed to gather, that the UDA in that area was not involved in this, maybe that spells out and links into our top debate. That's the realpolitik of Northern Ireland. You can't pretend these people don't exist, and you can't pretend our politicians don't know what they're thinking sometimes.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're a politician for a certain area, you should be able to tap into the thinking of whatever community groups, even if they are paramilitary-linked community groups, are in that area. And I know that there are some ex-prisoners who do work in South Belfast, which has moved on. It is linked to this sort of transition and process, if you like. But there are also members of the UDA who orchestrated and were involved in those race hate riots that took place not so long ago. And there are also elements of the UDA who control a lot of what goes on there. If you listen to just your earlier report in terms of politicians being put out of that area, in terms of shopkeepers having their businesses destroyed, if you take a look at the state of Sandy Row when you walk down it, which was once a thriving shopping community, a great wee businesses all along that road. There's boarded up shops. There's people who have tried to set up businesses and have ended up having to leave because they've been extorted or they've been threatened. And the reason why a lot of the areas, when you come to talk about the LCC meeting with ministers, be that about housing or education, a lot of the problems that are caused, especially in working class loyalist communities, are actually caused by the paramilitary. So the reason for meeting those paramilitaries then goes out the window. If you're talking about housing, what the minister should have been asking the LCC, well, can you go back to the organisations you represent and get us a commitment that if we start building houses, that the builders won't be extorted, that when the houses are complete, that there won't be graffiti written all over them saying locals only, that people who try and move into them won't be intimidated out if their face doesn't fit. And that's the only questions you should really be asking those type of organisations when it comes to those sort of, when it comes to housing, when it comes to education. A good start would be to stop recruiting young people.
That's kind of nub of the issue. So is that negotiating with the UVF? UVF, could you ask, you know, asking the LCC to negotiate with them, you know, could you ask them to please not drive people out of their homes and burn them out? Should a minister be doing that?
Well, I think at the very least, if you're going to meet with these people, you should be asking hard questions and not pretending that they're some sort of Boy Scouts, you know, who have never been involved or don't have influence over the people who are involved. And that's, the LCC is an umbrella group for those organisations. And while we recognise there are people such as the chairman of the LCC who is not involved in paramilitary organisations, the leadership of those groups do sit on the LCC. David Campbell said this week, he said actually last night on UTV that the people in the LCC are ex-paramilitaries. They're not. If they were ex-paramilitaries, the LCC would be able to come out and say that we have completed our purpose, that the paramilitary groups have now disbanded, that they have disbanded their structures. There's no leadership. There's no recruiting. They're not. They're active paramilitaries. They're not ex-paramilitaries. Ex-paramilitaries would indicate that those groups no longer exist, and they do. So that's just wrong to say. There are people who are heavily involved in the LCC since it was formed in 2015 who've been subject to police investigations. I mean, these are people who are still active on the ground. But the reality is, and the Independent Reporting Commission repeatedly points this out in their annual reports, the police do deal with them and the politicians do deal with them and negotiate with them during trouble. And sometimes it is what they call, I suppose, least worst option policing. You go and negotiate with someone to have trouble stopped, to have them use their influence to maybe get young people away from interfaces, to use their influence positively. And there are ex-prisoners who are very much involved in that kind of work for the betterment of their communities. But there are also active loyalist paramilitaries who are involved in the extortion and intimidation of anyone trying to better that community, trying to set up a business, trying to bring some sort of positive investment. And there's nothing that's going to scare away investment quicker than knowing that if they try and set up a business there, that they're going to have to also say, pay somebody for security that they don't actually need.
I'm starting to think Buckler's taken over this show. Here we're playing a clip from him again from Gamu last month, Assistant Chief Constable Bobby Singleton. And the reason I'm playing this clip this morning, it's starting to look, John Burroughs, like there is a change of policy. And I wonder if this is because of John Boucher, the new Chief Constable. But it certainly looks like there is a new policy from the PSNI that they will go in and take down signs. Why am I playing this clip from Good Morning Ulster? Well, have a listen. This was just a matter of days ago to how Assistant Chief Constable Bobby Singleton was taking aim at the Department for Infrastructure on a delay of taking down posters.
It has taken far too long. And as I say, it's got to the point where police have decided that we must intervene. Albeit, we still maintain the position that actually the removal should have been done by the Department for Infrastructure.
So, John Burroughs, that was just a few days ago that Singleton said that. Look, it's up to the Department of Infrastructure. We know the housing executive have gone in. Here's the second time now, John Burroughs, in a matter of days, when the police have gone in, taken down this sign at the Boyne Bridge, when a year ago they probably wouldn't have done. They would have stood back and they would have all blamed each other. The police are doing it now, John. Is this a new policy, do you think?
I think it's a little bit early to say whether it's a completely new policy. Certainly, the Chief Constable, John Boucher, said at the last policing board meeting that he felt that the police could be more robust. I've said that in the past, and I can't think of any time in my police career where I wouldn't have had that sign removed. I think on the scale of obviousness, this was a very obvious one for the police to intervene with. It had been freshly erected. It was clearly an offence, intimidation.
There's been loads of signs. Look at the signs and the intimidation there's been in housing developments, and the police have gone nowhere near them. Tell you what, next sign goes up, there'll be questions asked if they don't take them down now.
Look, absolutely. Where something is a clear-cut crime, the police should be ensuring that is removed. They may need logistical support to do that. That's where a good memorandum of understanding with the Department of Infrastructure, who sometimes have the capacity to take things down if they're very high up. But look, you know, the police should be swift, visible and robust in dealing with this kind of intimidation. They took it down. They should now be investigating that offence. And if we can bring people to account, we should do. I think we'll need to see how this pans out in the long term.
Alison, do you think there's a change of policy now? Or even if they haven't meant it, it'll be hard for them to not now implement a new policy? They've taken down two. Why aren't they taking down the next one, Alison?
Yeah, I think that the fact that when they took down one of the signs, it looked like there had maybe been a shift change, but now the fact that this was so quickly removed would maybe show that there has been a policy change. But, I mean, as you say, we watch these things carefully, because signs like this, intimidating signs that are clearly meant to intimidate other workers or residents of a particular area, they'll pop up from time to time. We know that. We report on that. And it'll be interesting to see, is this a complete policy change? The other thing that I would say is rather what Evan Putt said was quite significant, because is it only if it's established that there was no paramilitary involvement that the sign was taken down? Had the sign been taken down if the UDA had said, yeah, we stuck it up there, and if you take it down, we're going to start trouble, would the sign still be there? Do you know what I mean? So it'd be interesting to know what negotiations went on behind the scenes, yeah, and why the sign was taken down, yeah, so quickly.
Okay. Alison, thank you. John Burroughs, thank you very much. We're going to come back to our top story this morning. We know that the Education Minister, Paul Given, has turned down over 200 different organisations in terms of meeting them. He's met over 300. We know one of the 300 is the LCC. I've been speaking to the Alliance MLA and Chair of the Education Committee, Nick Matheson, about this.
I think really we're in a scenario that a bad situation has been made worse. The interactions in the Assembly Chamber yesterday really just leave us with yet more questions around how on earth the Education Minister, and I would add his colleague in the Communities Department, can justify and continue to attempt to justify, I think, in ever more strident terms, the decision to meet with the LCC, who represent prescribed paramilitary organisations, despite clear evidence of hundreds of meeting requests with other bona fide organisations having been declined. I think we really are in a scenario where the Minister is not connected with reality and not in touch with the public mood on this issue at all.
Well, the Minister, as you know, yesterday in the Assembly brought up the example of John Hume meeting Gerry Adams. Do you not think Hume should have met Adams?
I think we need to understand we are in a very different context now. We are, you know, over 25 years on from the Good Friday Peace Agreement, and the question is simply how long do these groups need to transition? The Minister made a lot in his answers yesterday around in Northern Ireland being prepared to accept that people can have a past and that does not mean they cannot have a future. I don't disagree with that. But my question is the Minister confident that the people that are represented by the LCC simply have a past, or do they still have a present that is involved in criminal exploitation? And that is the issue. We are simply long, long past the time for these groups to transition. They need to leave the stage. That is not to say those who have had a history in terms of our conflict cannot contribute to society. But if you remain a member of a prescribed organisation that is involved in inflicting harm and misery on our children and young people, then I'm afraid you're not an appropriate group to have your views represented to the Education Minister.
So beyond, Nick, you telling them to go away, what are you and the Alliance Party doing to get the UDA, the UVF, to transition finally?
I have to say I am growing tired of the term transition. I think that, you know, under in the Justice Department, under the leadership of Naomi Long, it is a clear priority to deal with paramilitarism, and that needs to be a criminal justice response.
So what are you
instance.
What are you doing to get them to go? They're not. They haven't gone away. They're still here, as you've said. Some of them are still active. So Paul Givens reaching out to the LCC. He's trying to get these people to go away through that route. What are you doing? What's the Alliance Party strategy to get them to go away?
I think a couple of points on that. First of all, you know, Naomi Long has been very clear in terms of the robust criminal justice response that is needed to deal with the criminality that these groups are involved with, and that needs to continue to be a priority, and it needs to be properly resourced by the executive. Clearly, there is a wider strategy around tackling paramilitarism, and yes, that does bring in education, but that does not bring in engaging with the very groups that are involved in paramilitarism, or at least a body that represents their views, to find out how they would like the Education Minister to deal with his responsibilities under the Tackling Paramilitarism Programme. I think we need to be realistic that I can't imagine another democratic society where we would be even having this debate and effectively asking, should the Education Minister, or indeed any minister in a decision-making role in a democratic society, be listening to a group that reflect the views of organised criminals? I mean, I simply cannot understand how anybody can justify that. And I think it was very interesting yesterday in the chamber when I asked the minister to provide his assessment of the extent to which the LCC represents the views of illegal organisations. He didn't answer the question. He gave us lots of information about the past and the history of Northern Ireland, but very little about the present. Who do these groups represent now? And on what level can he justify them having a role in policy making in Northern Ireland? I think we all just need to get real about this, and I think any right-thinking person would be horrified, in fact, by the contributions from the minister yesterday and the refusal to accept that perhaps this was a misjudgment and needs a serious rethink.
Nick, thank you very much indeed. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. Don't forget Nolan Live back on the TV. It's tomorrow night, Wednesday night, 10:40, BBC One. This guy, Ben Goa, you'll have heard him being talked about in the news, Professor Raphael Ben Goa. He led a major review into what we needed to do here in terms of our health service 8 years ago, and his recommendations basically never saw the light of day because of storm and stop-start government, the COVID pandemic, and all that comes with it. Well, he was back in Northern Ireland in recent days, and he says that transforming our health system here is more pressing than ever. Many of you will have experienced waiting lists and different aspects of the NHS needing more funding. Does that need radical reform? There are a few people saying that it doesn't. Earlier this month, Mike Nesbitt, our health minister, launched a report into the future of your healthcare in Northern Ireland. And it has recommended keeping all five area hospitals and investing in regional centres of excellence for specific medical treatments. In other words, rather than you being able to get a heart operation or whatever operation it is close to where you live, what's more important is that wherever you have to travel to, be it longer, you're getting the very best people that can do that operation. And yes, you have to travel further. This also says that there should be a drive towards separating emergency cases and planned procedures at different locations. Mike Nesbitt said that would mean patients may have to travel further for certain types of care, but you'd be seen faster.
Sustainability and resilience, taking account of our workforce, safety considerations and advances in modern medicine, it's simply not possible to deliver all services in every hospital. And it's already the case that different hospitals have different services available, so the network approach will ensure that people can still get the right treatment in the right place by the right person, even if it's not necessarily in the hospital closest to their home.
Now, John Compton used to be at the top of the tree of running all of this stuff. He was the former chief executive of the Health and Social Care Board. He's been looking at the report and he's spoken to the Nolan Show.
I think it's a little bit bland in terms of its arguments about why change is coming. It doesn't, I think, assertively say a little bit about those in terms of workforce, money, medical change and technology, all of which are driving that sort of need to change.
And of course, you know, for change to be accepted and for the Department of Health to bring people along with them, they need to punch through in terms of the media agenda. We know that because that message needs to get not just to the public, but to the leaders, the politicians, the staff.
Yes.
So you're accusing this report of being bland. What have they been bland about in terms of how would you have sold it?
Well, I think you should have said a bit more, for example, about workforce and money. You know, we spend, we currently get about 52% of the Northern Ireland bloc. We have about north of 10% of the workforce. Those numbers are not likely to change. We inside the numbers, they'll change and where it's spent will change. And I think they should have said a little bit more about that and should have had a bit more information in the document about those things in terms of trends and expenditure, etc.
But what do you, in layman's terms, what is the message that, what about the staff?
Well, in staff terms, you know, at one level, the report says we're going to maintain everything that we have because we need every square inch. And then it says we're going to make changes. Well, the two things are slightly inconsistent, I think. You know, yes, you do need to use the estate and you need to use it sensibly and you need to use it well. But this is about change. It's and it has the sort of the feeling of it's a document which is to reassure that we're not going to do something catastrophic and close places all over the shop. But on the other hand, I think they need to sort of say to the public, look, in 10 years' time, things like robotic surgery will be here. We'll need to understand how we manage our stroke services. We'll need to understand how we manage the new drugs that are coming in, the new technologies that are coming in. We'll need to understand the numbers that we can have in workforce. And all of that will push us to change. So I thought...
Don't they do that in this?
Well, they reference it, but I would have thought a bit more powerfully. They should have said that. They should have explained a little bit more powerfully why the change is coming.
If there is not radical change, is the health service going to fall over?
No, what will happen? Language is always very important when you're talking about the health service. People talk about it being broken and all of that sort of stuff. And on a day, for example, when you're running a story about perhaps someone who's 80 plus waiting in ED, the same day, lots of people will have had really positive things happen to them. It's not a binary thing. It's a yes or it's a no sort of thing. So what happens if you don't make the change is that the change happens, but it happens in an unplanned way and it looks chaotic. And it is chaotic. And what this document, I think, is trying to tell people is we don't want unplanned change. We want to manage that change.
But you're talking about how important it is to punch through with straight answers. How chaotic, how bad is it going to be if there's not this radical change that is needed in Northern Ireland?
Well, we've had examples, haven't we, of that where surgical services have had to shut pretty rapidly in a couple of locations. And so that's the sort of thing that's going to continue to happen. And I think the document is trying to say, look, we do want this to happen. We want to be managing it. We want to be controlling it. But I think they should have said more assertively that if we don't, we'll get into those problems and into those situations. And everybody will look to us and say, well, you should have known this was going to happen. Why did you let it happen?
So the document is suggesting that you've referred to the estate, and what they said was the reality is we will continue to need every square inch of our acute hospital capacity. They talk about the five hospitals for acute care, Craigavon, Antrim, Altnagelvin, Ulster, Belfast. Where's the change going to be if none of the hospitals are going to close?
Well, you see, I think the idea of closure, what I think he's tried to set out quite sensibly is that there are different roles for different hospitals. So we will, in the end, move towards five large hospitals, which will have, if you like, the services that most people would understand a hospital to have, you know, surgery, medicine, obstetrics, etc., in the middle of all of that. And we'll do that in a way that allows those hospitals to develop. And they will be supported by local hospitals and supported by a more junior form of acute hospital. And there'll be one or two regional specialties. But I think if you had been able to say, well, this is why, for example, we're having to do this. We know in our workforce, here's our workforce projections. this is what it tells us. We know in our financial projections, this is what it tells us. And that's the only point that I'm really making, that the way in which it's described is entirely sensible, but I think they could have been much more assertive in it.
We are back then to this old chestnut of people having to travel for care. And you've explained to us when you were in the job that it's much better, but we need to get this message through to the people that even if they're driving longer, they're driving to a specialist centre and their outcomes are better. Has that message got through to enough people?
I think it has got through to enough people nowadays. I don't think people... Travel is not the issue it once was, I think, for people in Northern Ireland.
So why isn't this done?
Well, that's the point. The point about it is that you can't, you know, somebody once described it to me like you're trying to rebuild the plane at the same time as fly the plane. So what you're trying to do is you're running the services today and you're trying to rebuild them. So it is not straightforward. It is not simple to do. And it does take time and it does take a sort of a measured response to it. I just think that you should be more straight with the public. You know, our workforce will only let us run it this way because that's the way they're trained. Our money will only let us provide it this way because that's the way it's done. Medical treatments and changes are coming. Here's what they are in 10 years' time. And, you know, we have technology coming. We have AI coming. We have interventional radiology. All these things are coming which will force the change.
What's not in this document are costings, the money.
Yes.
And you can't talk about health without talking about money. I certainly don't know of any interview where it hasn't come up.
Well, there are two things I would say about that. First of all, this is a document which is, if you like, looking for support for a proposition. This is how we want to do it. And we want to get permission. And you can get permission for that. But much, much more importantly, will there be the permission for implementation.
And that's down to money.
And that's where the implementation comes, where the money is, and how you handle the money. So, and yes, money is hugely important in terms of the running of a health service.
So how is this document useful if it doesn't get into how much it would cost to do it?
I'm hoping that it's part of a two-step thing, that the first thing is the document is telling you about the direction of travel, and it will be followed up by an implementation document which will talk to you about the timing of the change and where the changes will happen and the costings of those changes.
And you will be aware of the regular conversations around Stormont giving the health service more and more and more money. So how do we square the circle in this country around the instinctive acceptance that health always gets more and more money and people wondering if it is efficient enough and actually could it be doing a lot more to not need much more money?
Well, in terms of the second document I'm talking about, the implementation, as much time should be spent on how we spend our current money. So at the moment, I think we spend about 52% of the block, 8 billion, thereabouts. I don't think that number is going to really significantly change because the implications for the rest of public services would be just too difficult for us here in Northern Ireland. So, you know, instead of always asking for more, we need to also concentrate on where and what we spend.
You talk about in 10 years' time, where will we be? Are we likely to continue the trajectory that if you've got money, you go private? Even if you don't have money, you borrow it, you go private. Is the private sector always going to be more efficient, more readily available if you're in trouble than the NHS?
Well, I think we've come to a situation, haven't we, just it's a de facto situation where people now are much more commonly use the private sector. And I think that, you know, that's like sort of to say I don't want that to happen is a bit like King Canute sort of trying to hold the tide back. It's here. And so the system needs to work alongside it. It needs to see how it can do that. So if the private sector can do some things a little bit more efficiently than the public sector, well then there's nothing to stop the public sector buying from the private sector in those areas. Now,
it already does that, doesn't it?
It does. But I think in that regard, probably a much more structured and formal partnership-y type arrangement. Instead of, you know, I have an amount of money, can you do a number of things for me? Let's get to a different position where there's a different arrangement and a different way of working in the midst of all of that. That's not to advocate, you know, private is good and we should go private. It's just to accept the reality of where we are.
While we're talking about this today, we're pre-recording this. I can write the script, right?
Yes.
There will be people calling us when they hear this interview and they'll be saying, but hold on a minute here. If you integrate that those private practices into the NHS model, the public are paying to train some of these clinicians, train some of these surgeons, and then they're making a fortune on the private sector. So what about this split between these people who, you know, who work for the NHS and the private sector?
Well, I mean, this is the, you know, this is the conundrum. It's a legal thing, isn't it? So somebody works and they do their 40 hours per week for the state and working in the NHS, and they wish to work another 10 hours a week and they do it in the independent sector. I mean, that's the reality of life. That applies to any form of life that we have in any form of...
Is it right?
Well, you know... It's,
rather than them doing those extra 10 hours a week for the NHS on overtime salary?
I don't think that's a question that you... There is no answer to that question because it's not about right and wrong. It's about an individual choosing to spend their time doing something.
Yeah, but the power lies with those surgeons, with those clinicians, doesn't it? And look, what we can't ignore is what the public who need to buy into all of this regularly talk about. And for example, they will regularly phone programmes like mine and they will say that they're interacting with someone within the NHS and that person looks at them and says, look, you'll have to wait a year. If you go private with me, you'll see you in 2 weeks. And it's the same individual. Is that ethical?
Well, no. I mean, if it's definitely if it happens like that, that is not ethical. It's not
that
correct.
That is happening.
Well, you know, one or two individuals may do that. The majority of the way it happens is that people approach the organisation and then they get referred to a doctor.
Yeah, but
in
they're
the
told, John, to approach the organisation, aren't they? During the consultation with the same surgeon, the same clinician.
Well, that's right. People do that, and certainly in general practice as well, people will say if you've got private and you go ahead and do it. But you can't stop that. How can you stop? How can you legislate to stop that? You can't make it illegal.
Well, as part of this new model that we're looking at going forward, you could somehow incentivize those people to work more for the NHS.
But that does happen. But remember, if you take waiting list initiatives, the first place that people will go to is they'll say to a trust, for example, can you do something on a Saturday or a Sunday to do this and we'll pay you to do extra and we'll pay the doctors and the nurses extra to do it over the Saturday and Sunday. So they will have the opportunity to do that.
Does the private sector pay more? Is that the incentive for these people?
Not particularly, I don't think. I mean, I think in terms of the waiting list prices and stuff like that, that's published. There's a published price for it. It's what you get for particular procedures and stuff like that there. So I don't think it's in that regard it's paid anymore.
No, look, I'm asking these questions about the private sector. To be fair, it provides such a service in Northern Ireland that the system would be falling over if nobody could go private.
Well, it would be more difficulty. There would be undoubtedly more difficulty and more people would wait longer. You know, and by the way, that's why I sort of think that ultimately, if you're mature about this and you're in charge of the health service for Northern Ireland, you need to have a relationship with all of your providing organisations. That's the 95% that's in the NHS and the 5% or so that's in the private sector.
Can I ask you about waiting lists?
Yeah.
Are they so bad now that it's close to the point where many people within their lifetimes will not see it become reasonable again?
Well, certainly the anecdotal information suggests that a lot of people are waiting. I mean, they're effectively not on a waiting list because they're waiting so long. For me, the main concern about the waiting lists is that, and I think this back to this document, I think is trying to say, and Mike Nesbitt, the minister, is trying to say, look, I want to put control in place here about how we handle this. I don't want it to be uncontrolled or anything of that nature. But I do think somebody needs to get real control of waiting lists.
How? What should they be doing? What's real control look like?
Well, I think, for example, if you read in the document, it tells you that there's, you know, about 200,000 or 300,000 people waiting and various things. I think it's better to look at where are they waiting, and broadly they wait in categories of general surgery, orthopaedics, ophthalmology, specialist diagnostics and stuff like that. So because the solutions to those are all different. You know, how you would fix a waiting list for cataracts is not how you would fix a waiting list for general surgery. So I think you need to look at it slightly differently, and you need to have different solutions.
Are you talking about an individual? Because ultimately everything's Mike Nesbitt's responsibility now. Are you talking about different czars being in charge of different...
You can do it in many ways, can't you?
So what way would you do it? What do you mean?
In many ways, you could have someone who's in charge of the waiting lists and who's working with the hospitals and with the independent sector to structure...
That's the minister.
I'm talking about operation. The minister's in charge in terms of the direction of travel, as this document says. But on the day-to-day ground, whenever you're getting called for your procedure and stuff like that, there's an individual who's in charge of that, spending the money, saying it's getting done here, performance managing, how people are doing it.
So there could be individual czars, individual, you know, public profile people, and their task is to get that individual waiting list down.
Yes, I think you have to, you know.
Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I looked at it a bit. Look at things that work quite well and have worked quite well in the past. So I think most people would think, for example, our vaccination program during COVID worked very successfully. And why did that work successfully? Because ministerially you had the right direction of travel, like this document is stating. Also, an individual was in charge of the whole vaccination program, and they organised the vaccination program, and they sorted all of that out, and you gave information to the public. And then you asked them to do something to get their vaccine. And guess what they did? Well, you know, when you have a way of working that is successful, don't try to reinvent the wheel. Use what's successful, because you'll find that the same success can be achieved in things like waiting lists and so forth.
So, John, one of the other things that is talked about in this report that we all need to clock is this growing population that we have, because we're living longer. That's a good thing. We're getting older. How does that play into, for example, incidents of dementia?
Well, I think, again, in regards to the document, I think the minister could have made more of the whole population information as a driver for change. So in particular, if you look at the growth in over 65s, over 75s, over 85s, it is really very, very substantial. And that's going to put enormous pressure on our hospital sector and what we need to do in our hospital sector. For example, generally speaking, about one person in three over the age of 85 has dementia, and the numbers are growing from about whatever it is, 20,000 to 48,000 over the period of time. So you see that
over what period of time?
I think it's over a 20-year period. You see that colossal growth, but that's only in the one section. I mean, there'll be a lot of people a lot younger than that have dementia as well, and you drop into the over 75s and over 65s. So it's a huge, huge pressure on the system in the middle of all of that. And I thought in the document, that's why I thought in the document he could have made much more of the information that's currently available to tell you why we need to really, really push and make the change.
So what are we going to do about that? So we have a lot more older people, thank goodness, they're living longer. Yeah. But by implication, that means we're going to have a lot more people with dementia in Northern Ireland. That's a pressure in its own right.
It is indeed. And the biggest problem that we have there is that, and it's not just in Northern Ireland, you see it right across the UK, you see it in the south of Ireland as well, is this... Because it's such a problem, this avoidance of the social care problem, how are we going to fix social care is essentially, and that's a very sharp focus about social care and how we're going to fix it. And again, I would have thought in the document he could have made more of the need to, in parallel with doing the hospital thing, do more with social care, because if you don't do that, you're going to transmit big pressures onto hospitals.
But we're getting older as we speak. More people are living longer as we speak.
Yep.
So, like, never mind 10 or 20 years' time, where are we in the next year, 2 years, 5-year period with a growing population of people with dementia?
struggling is the truth of the matter. We're struggling. We're struggling to provide adequate care. We're struggling to provide adequate home care. We're struggling to provide adequate specialist care. And people are doing the best they can, but we are struggling. It's not. This is not something that will happen. This is something we are currently experiencing.
And the reason that will resonate with so many people who listen to me, they will either be the children of mums and dads who are at that stage, or they will be in their 60s or their 70s, whatever, and one of the worries is, can I stay in my own home if I get sick?
Yes.
Will there be care packages so that I don't have to go into a home?
Yes.
Well, dependent on the level of care, the availability of care will affect whether you can stay in your own home, how comfortable you are when you get sick, how safe you will currently feel with the fear of getting older.
Yes. That's
huge, this.
That's right. And again, that's why when he talks, he mentions workforce in the document and the change, why I thought he should have made more of the workforce issue, more of the money issue, more of the population issue. Instead of just a commentary that these things are here, you should, I think, have said a little bit more assertively, because these things are here, the changes that we're going to face in our hospital sector, in our acute sector, in our social care sector are really quite significant, and we need, therefore, to manage that change.
You say, finally, John, you say that we're currently struggling in terms of providing care to those people with dementia.
Yes.
So what is the reality then?
So, well, the reality is that families are left to deal with. Families are left feeling unsupported, I think, in many instances. The care is probably less than we would like to give. It's not that the professionals going to see somebody don't know what they need. It's their ability to organise and provide it.
But what does that result in for the person with dementia?
It results in a poorer quality of life.
Like what?
Well, they live in a more isolated world. They don't have as much support. They get ill. They are taken into hospital. And then they're in a hospital bed, and then there's a struggle to get them out of the hospital bed.
And final question, what do you make of Mike Nesbitt? Is it too early to tell? And what did you make of his predecessor?
Well, look, from my point of view, I have a lot of respect for anybody who's in a ministerial role. I know, one of the few people in Northern Ireland know how difficult a job it is, how stressful a job it is. So I think that Mike Nesbitt has approached the job very well. He's approached it maturely. He comes across very straightforwardly, comes across as an honest guy trying to do a decent job.
If it's such a big job, and you know how big it is, can you be a health minister and a leader of a political party at the same time?
That's a call for him. I mean, that's really a political call for him. I mean, it's...
Yeah, but you're free now that you can answer that honestly.
Yeah, no, but it's self-evident, isn't it, that it's very difficult to do two big jobs, always very difficult to do two big jobs. But that's a call for him. And that's, you could say, well, for example, his colleague Naomi Law has done the job quite successfully, being leader of a party and a minister as well. So it's not that it's not that it's impossible to do. It just means that he'll have less time in his life to do other things.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
John Compton, former head of the Health and Social Care Board. That's it from us for today. Enjoy your Tuesday. We'll be back together again tomorrow morning, Wednesday morning at 9. Thanks for listening. Have a good day, everyone.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @Stephen Nolan.